Okay. Today on Pro Mindset, we have a gentleman, Stephen Drum. Stephen is a retired Navy SEAL with a total of 27 years in military service. He served in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan and served on strategic missions and operations around the world. He's trained thousands of U.S. and foreign special operation forces. Stephen was selected to be the mastermind, architect, and co-creator of the U.S. Navy's Warrior Toughness Program, which was the headspace program to train Navy sailors and officers to perform their best under the pressure of combat and the stresses of military life. Today, Stephen is an author, speaker, consultant, and coach related to how to perform under pressure and execute in challenging environments. He is the author of the book titled Life on the X. Stephen, welcome to Pro Mindset today.
Hey, how you doing, Craig? Thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on with you today.
Okay, so I'm going to jump right into it. I just read your book, Life on the X. What is your thesis statement? Why don't you share for the audience your thesis statement for your book?
Well, I'll start by simply saying, you know, we all have moments, and I won't just simply just give the thesis statement, but I'll say we all have moments in our lives, right? And they vary in terms of importance, right? We have moments in terms of being a parent, being a father, a husband, a wife, whatever, where we simply need to show up and be able to lead and be present in that moment. And then on the other side of that extreme, we have high pressure situations, whether it's athletic competition, whether it's a business situation, or maybe it's like a real life and death situation. And so we really need to be able to be consistent in how we show up to life's most important moments. And so in the SEAL teams, we have, before we deploy overseas on combat, we have a level of readiness, almost like a rating or a score that we have to attain before we go overseas to fight the enemy. And so as we move through, we attain a higher level of readiness until we achieve a satisfactory level of readiness. And essentially, the book intends to walk you through. It gives you stories to entertain, but also it's prescriptive in nature for you to identify key moments, defining opportunities for you, and really for you to feel ready and poised, confident to execute in those moments and situations.
Okay, so I'm going to take you back. How long have you been retired?
Since 2019, December of 2019, launched my speaking business like 2 months before COVID. So yeah.
Okay, so let's go back in time when you were mentoring, you know, SEALs candidates, and you gave them an introductory speech that you talked about in your book. Would you mind share? Why don't you give that speech to me, unabbreviated, unabridged?
So I'll do it to best of my recollection in terms of just actually saying it, but it'd be something in the terms of, you know, to set the scenes. When we'd have a new class of a SEAL candidate, so in order for you to be an enlisted sailor to try out to be a Navy SEAL, you had to have a contract. Means you had to screen and take a test before you even showed up to Navy boot camp. And once you got there, you were put in your own division for you and other SEAL candidates that had those contracts. And so they had their own drill instructors, but our job in what we call a dive motivator, our job was to get them ready for their next phases in the pipeline or selection process, you know, BUDS, SEAL training after they left boot camp. And so we'd run them through progressive workouts, intensive mentoring sessions. And so the example I provide in the book is really like, hey, how I would kick off that first mentoring session. And it would look like this. My staff and I would get in our Navy vans, we'd drive over to the other side of base where they were sitting in their compartments, and they were typically, the drill instructors would have them sitting on the floor, lined up in little columns, sitting there, you know, crisscross applesauce, right, sitting on the floor with their pens, their notepads out, you know, waiting for that pearl, those pearls of wisdom, that motivational speech, I guess, you know, at 5 a.m. in the morning. But I would always start off, when it was my turn to give that, I would start off by saying, guess what, gents? Most of you are not going to make it through SEAL training. You know, and you could see kind of the little sad little puppy dog looks on their face, right? That's not how they wanted their motivational speech to go at 5 a.m. But I said, here's the thing. Statistically, most of you will not be successful. But the thing is they were smart, you know, very smart, highly educated in terms of the demographics you typically see at boot camp. But they knew it to be true. They knew that the attrition rate was anywhere from 75 to 90% of them, you know, would not be successful. And then I'd ask them why. I said, why do you think you won't be successful? And, you know, they'd always give the same answers. Well, we're not fast enough. We're not good enough in the water. We're going to get hurt and they'll kick us out. We're going to fail a bunch of stuff and they'll get rid of us. And I said, yeah, I said, here's the thing. Some of you will get hurt and have to be removed from training. Some of you will fail to meet the standards. I said, but for most of you, you'll be unsuccessful, not because of that reason. It'll be because of this. You see, one night you'll be cold, you'll be wet, you'll be tired. And there'll be a little voice inside your head that says, you don't belong here. You're not good enough. In fact, just quit, get warm, get fed, get rested, then go pick an easier job in the Navy because you don't need this. And many of you in that moment of weakness, you will be disconnected from your goal and you will make the decision to disenroll from training. But for many of you who do so, you will come to regret that decision, sometimes even minutes after you made it, because you get that moment of clarity and you realize that if you've just been that much more committed, if you've been able to kind of regulate those emotions just a little bit better, you'd still be on the path to your goal. And essentially that's what I started off by telling them. And that was really to pave the way in terms of getting them to really understand that being physically prepared was super important, but it was not nearly enough. We had to build the mindset. We had to really address the character piece to align the actions and behaviors with the daily goals that they'll face when it gets hard, when it gets difficult.
Stephen, one of the things that I found interesting in your book was you talked about one of your colleagues and friends, John, who was very talented, committed, had all the attributes that you look for in a SEAL member, but he quit with just a few days left. Why do some guys that have, you know, they're cut out for it. They were created for this purpose, and yet they still quit. Why did guys like John quit?
Well, you know, it's not as easy to just offer up because it's very formulaic. And for years, they've been trying to really come up with the recipe. Because at the end of the day, right, we want to select the right people, and we would prefer to select a higher amount of the right people, especially in today's climate when recruiting is down. But fundamentally, if you had to pick one thing, it really comes down to a level of commitment. Now, the better you are across the board, the better you are at swimming, the better you are at focus, at running, that's less of a stressor overall. So the higher level of your physical performance, in many cases, the less stress you're going to feel. But even I've seen world-class athletes, right, former triathletes, in fact, who ended up quitting. Because you just, when the pressure's really on, a lot of times emotions get in the way of good decision-making. And you start to tell yourself, you start to listen, and this is big in performance psychology. If left unchecked, the thoughts, the self-talk we have in our head, often it will derail you from your goals. It will derail your focus. And so you really need to be able to have a level of detachment sometimes and say, okay, I feel these certain things, but let me take a step back and let me choose an action or a behavior that gets me to the goal. And often I think when it comes to that, and I don't know exactly why John quit that day. Again, as you mentioned, he was a complete stud, good at everything. He was kind of a voice of reason. When I lacked confidence and buzz, he was kind of there. But I just think at a certain point, when you're under that level of mental stress and fatigue, the emotions and this negative self-talk can get the better of you. And you realize just, or maybe it just reveals to you that you're really not as committed, right? Maybe you're trying to do it for the wrong reasons. Maybe you just want to be a SEAL because you want to wear that gold trident, or you want to tell everybody you're a Navy SEAL. And in most cases, that's simply not enough to propel you through. You have to have a higher level of connection to that goal.
Well, one of the attributes of pro mindset is the idea that your identity, your story, will either propel you or hold you back. And most of the time, it holds us back. It's the things people have told us, the circumstances we've experienced, the things we tell ourselves, that unless we go into an opportunity with a clean slate, it isn't the preparation that's going to hold us back. It's not the training. It's not our preparedness. It's our past. And it's what happened in the seventh grade. It's what happened on the soccer field and on the freshman soccer team that they bring with them to the SEAL, you know, candidacy And you don't sometimes know what that is. And that's what shows up and reveals itself when the stove gets really hot. When it's the most difficult is when those things come up. Is that a fair statement?
And that's a fair statement. At the end of the day, there has to be a level of belief, self-efficacy to know. And whatever the witch's brew, the formula, the recipe is for making that happen, as you rightly pointed out, it could be a number of things, right? It could be the confidence you gained from having the mindset where you consistently achieve goals. And you're like, if I put the work in, you can directly tie your experiences in the past to say, hey, this is the outcome that I got when I did certain things. But if you're kind of like me, where I wasn't a great athlete, I wasn't the most popular kid in school, right? I had what I would call maybe a chip on my shoulder, and I had to prove to other people that I had what it takes. But most importantly, I had to prove it to myself. And I attached so much weight to that goal. I was so heavily mentally invested in that process that I really saw no other alternative. I literally is like, if I get hurt, that's one thing, but I do not see any possible outcome other than success. I wouldn't believe anything less. And maybe, that worked for me. Maybe that's not what works for everybody, but I think there has to be, and I did, I lacked self-confidence oftentimes. I looked at SEAL training as this big mythical beast, and I'm like, can I really do that? I mean, the attrition rate is so high. Can I really do that? But each time that I started getting in it and I saw other people quit, I just felt more empowered. I felt stronger, and that self-belief and confidence grew.
I don't know if you found it in your experience or not, but I would say that, for professional athletes, a lot of times the guys that make it, it's their plan A and their plan B. They have no plan B. And for those guys that have a silver spoon or have a, middle-class lifestyle, and they've got options, they've got smarts. They don't have to beat their head against the wall to make a living. They can be successful in lots of different things. They don't make it. And so what you just described to me was when you define commitment in your book, you talk about all in. You got to be all in. Well, you can be all in on something and be all in on something else too. But to make it, you have to be all in solely on your mission, whatever your goal is and your dream is. Thoughts?
Now, and that's a difficult situation, right? There's a couple of different ways to look at that. Fundamentally, what I would recommend is you look at options that you have should this not work out. And you maybe write those down and you spend some time. You put that in a book, you close that book, and you set that aside. And then you forget that that exists. And you simply tell yourself, there is no option. Now, should the worst thing happen, maybe you get hurt. Maybe through no fault of your own, you find yourself unsuccessful in your goal. At that point, then you need to be able to pivot. But until that point, it doesn't do you any good in most cases to offer yourself that branch plan, because when you're really tested, like you said, when that stove gets turned up, it's often easiest to really talk yourself into choosing that path of least resistance, right? And you can even look at that in terms of like a fitness or a weight loss goal, right? You've got to like say, all right, I'm going to eat clean foods. I'm going to stick with, my diet plan. But then the second, you start to get really hungry or you start to feel stress, you start to rationalize, oh, I don't really need to do that. Oh, it's just one cookie. It's just one bag of chips, right? And next thing you know, you've gone down that path. So I think fundamentally, yes, you got to have the realistic ability to be able to pivot and adjust if things don't go, turn out how you want. But at a certain point, I think there has to be that level of singular focus on your goal. And we can talk more about that for sure.
Yeah. All right, Stephen. I've got a few terms that I want to throw, like put you in a hot box.
Sure.
And I want you to kind of share for our audience, a succinct definition. They've heard these terms before, but how does it apply to the SEAL world? Hell Week.
All right. Hell Week is the initial piece, right? You go through Hell Week is, they kind of adjust where it is in training, but it's in the, you have three phases of SEAL training. Once you start, you have a pre-phase, but once you start, there's three phases. And in the first phase, it's really the culmination of that first phase of training. It's the main event. Now you are tested on other types of water skills, drown proofing, underwater knot tying, things like that. But it's Hell Week is the main crucible of the entire thing of training. And it essentially tests two things. One, it simply tests, as I said before, your level of commitment. Because a lot of times your mind, even your body will say, hey, I can't go any further. I simply cannot go any further. But you have to have that mental fortitude to say, yes, I can push well past those preconceived, pre-imagined limits. And the second piece of that is, how well will I collaborate when things get really, really hard? Because one of the reasons our selection process is so hard is because the environment that we operate in is so difficult. When you start talking about operating around cold water, that really tests your focus and your endurance and your resilience. And so we've got to test for it there. And when you're feeling at your worst, will you still put the needs of your teammate, of your boat crew, of the mission above your own personal sense, you know, of suffering and self-interests? And if you can answer those two questions, you're going to make it through Hell Week.
What percent of the guys quit after Hell Week or during Hell Week?
That's tough to say. I know. Yeah, I would say if you have, let's say the attrition rate is, let's just say for argument's sake, let's say it's 80%. So I would say of the 80% that are attrited through Hell Week, you're probably looking at Hell Week itself, probably 55 to 60. And I'm kind of making that up a little bit, but you got to also account for a lot of injuries. And there also are performance things. And, you know, it's probably 50, 55%. And by the time you get to second phase, well, dive phase, you're going to lose some people there too through their test, the crucible there, which is called pull competency. And so injuries, performance failures, things like that, will make up probably the rest of that 80%. So it's the most significant period of attrition in terms of overall attrition of a SEAL training class.
Sounds like at least half of the people quit during Hell Week.
At least half of the people that won't make it will quit.
It's probably good for them that they do, so they don't have to put themselves through the phase two and phase three and then ultimately not make it anyway. So if you're going to quit, you might as well quit early.
Yeah, and you're gonna lose people throughout, but it's significantly, the attrition rate significantly drops off after Hell Week for sure.
Okay, so from your experience, when you went through it, as well as being an instructor and a trainer, what's the difference between the I'm just going to call them guys, the guys that make it, the people that make it, and the last one to quit? What did they have that last person to quit didn't have? What's the defining trait? Because the people that quit in Hell Week, they were not committed. They were not in shape. They couldn't handle it. It was too much. The volume of activity and pressure was too much. But for the last person that quits, they were right there. They were at the cusp of being in.
You talking about in third phase?
I'm talking last day, the last week. I'm talking about, it's in third phase, but why would you quit when you're almost there?
No, you most likely wouldn't. Most people at that point, you're not going to quit. You're not going to quit. It's most likely it's going to be a performance drop. Like you're not going to be you're going to be considered unsafe. You're not going to be able to do, because after, like, when you start looking at second phase, which is all diving, and third phase, which is all demolition weapons and land warfare tactics, it's really an assessment of your suitability to perform safely in a team construct in that type of environment. And so a lot of times it's going to be, now there's certain tests, like all of your swim tests and your obstacle courses, all of your run times, they all drop, right? They get harder. And so eventually, if you just can't pass it, you're going to get dropped. But it's also kind of like performance things. Maybe there's an integrity violation. Maybe you made a mistake and you lied about it. We lost a guy or two from that. So it's not going to really be a quit. Most of the quitting's done after Hell Week, or if you fail something, they tell you, hey, you got to go through Hell Week again, even though they made it through because they did something or they screwed up, then they may quit at that point. But for most, there's really not a lot of quitting after Hell Week.
Okay, going back to definitions. What's operation tempo mean?
So operational tempo is, in the context of a SEAL deployment, your tempo is how busy you are. And so early on in Iraq, operational tempo could be used in this example of every, like you may go out multiple times. So you may have a hit. You may get ready, put a mission planning template together, and you go out and you hit a building. You go out to grab these couple of guys. And then maybe from you question them or you gain intel, and then that leads to another target maybe on the other side of the city, and you may go and hit that target or a net fresh intel. And you may go, you may be doing it a lot. But like, if, for example, my last Iraq deployment, we were fairly busy. But as things got quieter, which was a sign of progress, and we started to push more and more on the Iraqi special operations forces, then our operational tempo dropped. We were less busy at that point. Not going out, maybe going out from every night to like once to twice a week.
Okay. Steven, let's go back to like the defining moment that you described in your book where you were under attack on a rooftop and, you know, you're in life or death type situation. How did you respond to your training? How did you respond to your identity? How did you reveal your identity? And how, you know, when you think back, I'm sure over the years you've thought back to that critical moment, because if that didn't come out the way it did, you may not be here or you may be in a different situation. How do you view that today? And what was your takeaways? What did you learn from it? What are you proud about and how you responded? What do you wish you would have did differently?
Well, one of the big things is, and I don't know who this, I think this may have been something from the Romans or the Greeks. They talk about, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the expression we use in the SEAL teams is, you know, when things go sideways, when like you're in combat, you're under fire, you're not going to magically rise to the occasion and do heroic and magical things. Instead, you can't count on that. Instead, you can only count on falling back on your level of training. So your level of training and how well equipped you are, you have to be able to have enough training in a situation where you walk into that situation feeling confident. And that doesn't mean you're not scared, but fundamentally it's that self-belief. It's belief in you. It's belief in those around you, your teammates. And so, and I also discussed how the thoughts in your head can distract you, right? If you're present, if you're mindful, it means you're focused on the here and now. But oftentimes those negative thoughts will start telling you about the consequences of the situation, right? So I'm on that rooftop getting shot at, and I'm feeling that fear because I'd never been in an intense gunfight like that. So immediately I start thinking about, okay, what happens if I get shot? What happens if I get killed? What happens if I get, you know, make a bad decision here as the team leader? But then I realize, okay, that's not helping me, right? And immediately I'm able to snap back because I remembered, you know, three stupid, simple words that we all know in the SEAL teams: shoot, move, communicate. It's a mantra that they use in, you know, performance psychology, that athletes use, that performance statement, that mantra, which is simply that reminder. It's that cue to snap your focus back. It goes from the negative thoughts to thoughts that serve you, that thoughts that elevate your level of confidence and actually direct your focus on the things that are important. In the battlefield, that's who's going where, who's doing what. Reading the battlefield, thinking two steps ahead of the enemy. Because when you're saying those three words, like, it pushes out the negative thoughts because you're occupying that headspace. And the thoughts in that headspace at this point are simply the actions and the behaviors that align with what you need to do to be successful.
Let's talk about that little voice. There's a gentleman that is a sports psychologist in Major League Baseball that played baseball in the leagues. And he's been on my podcast, and he talks about, he's called that the little man voice. And I think it's really difficult to do well in anything if you're having two conversations. You're doing two things at once. One is, like, even in our interview right here, we both have to be mindful. We both have things to do after this. We've got to be locked in and dialed in. We can't be thinking about how we're doing. You can't be anticipating what I'm going to ask next. or was your response appropriate, or could you said something different? Because if you have that little second conversation going, you can't be your best. So how does that, how do you put duct tape on that voice? You kind of shared with a little bit with the shoot, move. What was the thing again? Shoot, move, and communicate. But, you know, for the average, for the person out there working for a bank or working as a salesperson, it doesn't matter what they do, how can they put duct tape on that voice?
Well, don't think of it. My guidance would be, don't think of, like, you know, in basic psychology, don't tell yourself things not to do. And they, you know, when you have little kids, right, you're always told, don't tell your kids not to leave their clothes on the floor. Instead, tell your kids to put their clothes in the hamper or whatever you want them to do, giving that positive aspiration. So when you have negative thoughts, it's not about silencing those thoughts. It's about replacing those thoughts and reframing that situation, right? So instead of like, you know, I make a mistake and my initial thing is, right, I get frustrated with myself and I'm so stupid. I'm such an idiot. God, how could I make that mistake again? You catch yourself because you're mindful. You catch yourself saying those things. And rather than saying, don't say those things, don't say that, replace it. Just say, all right, I made a mistake. Why? Because I'm human. That's what we do. But I'm not going to make that mistake again. Here's what I'm going to do instead. This is what I'm going to do. Now, how do I optimize the best outcome, regardless of what happened, right? Regardless of how badly things went sideways. Here's what I'm going to do to optimize the situation. So it's a matter of replacing that with the thoughts that guide you. That's my recommendation.
Well, I played golf this morning, and I probably should have talked to you before I played golf. Because that little voice comes out when you hit bad shots from time to time. Okay, let's go back to the some of the definitions in your book. What is the what-if mindset? What's the what-if mindset?
The what-if mindset. I'm trying to – what's the context of that? I have to
– It was when things go sideways. Contingency plans.
Yeah. So, well, in terms of contingency plans, you always have to be ready for the what-if. So, thank you. And that starts at the planning. So you have, okay, you know, for example, we got ready to go out on a combat operation, the SEAL teams. Our commander gives us the guidance. They're like, all right, we go into this valley to interrupt enemy freedom of movement and disrupt their pattern of life. Here's what success looks like. Okay, here's your constraints, here's your limitations, here's your resources. But within that little box is what you can do, leverage your creativity. Okay, so then from that, we develop the tactical plan. We have, okay, we're going to execute this. This is what perfection looks like. Okay, but then we're going to walk through every phase of that operation. And that will start simply with walking out to the airfield. You're getting ready to take 4 Black Hawk helicopters. All of a sudden, the lead bird is leaking hydraulic fluid and it's down. Okay, well, that's the first contingency. Okay, we have a bump plan to address that. We have a bump plan for a helicopter not working. Okay, we can use 3 helicopters. We can allocate some of the key players from that first and we put it on those other 3 helicopters and we still continue the mission. Now, if a second helicopter breaks, can't do the mission. And then from there, what happens if that helicopter gets shot out of the sky? Okay, well, the contingency now is a whole different mission. What happens if we're sneaking to the target and we get engaged with the enemy and lose the element of surprise? That's the next contingency. Okay, so we walk through that. We have, it's called a rehearsal of contingency, but we have contingency by phases. So every phase of that operation, we have contingencies. And the key point here, though, is as it relates to kind of business or even athletics, the key point is not that you're always going to have the exact answer. Like, it's not realistic to anticipate every possible scenario, but you want to get in the habit of constantly walking into situations and saying, okay, I'm ready for the curveball. Today's the day I get thrown a curveball. Good. It's my opportunity to demonstrate that agility, that flexibility. It's my opportunity to demonstrate that leadership. So even if you don't have the right answer, even if you hadn't planned for that specific contingency, you're able to at least stop and maintain your poise and your focus. You don't flail. You don't come unglued. You're like, all right, so let me take a beat here and let me figure out what gets me the best outcome in that moment. It's really being able to maintain that poise in any kind of high stakes or important situation that matters.
Okay. So I'm testing you on your book because I was intrigued by your book. So I want to share some of those. Want you to share some of those principles to the for the audience. What do you mean by toggle between the micro and the macro when you're referring to variable focus?
Yeah. So there's a couple examples I can use for that. So in many cases we have in the military, it's like, okay, so we're in a dynamic combat environment, right? Let's say we're in a land warfare situation and you have to have like supreme focus. If you're looking down your sights, you're looking down your optics, like in order for you to engage an enemy target, you need that like very dialed in specific focus. And you take your shots, but you got to come down off that gun, right? Because you got to look around, especially if you're in a position of leadership, because now maybe the enemy's trying to flank or maneuver. Another example is, for example, our kind of emergency procedures. Like we walk in to clear a structure and we're engaging the enemy inside of a building. And all of a sudden, you know, our primary weapon system goes down. Maybe it's a malfunction or we've run dry on ammo. We're taught immediately and instinctively to go ahead and transition to our pistol. Right? That's the kind of thing that we drilled. Now, if we go out onto the street in an urban setting and the same thing happens, but now that enemy is about 200, 300 yards away, that's not going to work. So we need to be able to essentially, if you look at a combat operation, every choice or decision you make, think of it as almost like a menu item represented on like a large Italian menu for a restaurant. Each of those menu items, once you select one of them, you can perform that sequence instinctively without thinking, muscle memory, automaticity. But you have to have the toggle switch at that macro view. You have to become aware of the whole situation to make sure that you can select the right item off that menu, if that makes sense. Another example is to think of, you know, if you think of, let's say, if you've seen it on TV, maybe you've seen it on like one of the Chicago Meds or Chicago Fire, right? There's a mass casualty. Think of like a big train wreck or something like that. And the doctor comes on scene. It's mass casualties. Okay, they're looking around. They're triaging. They're assessing. Once they go in to treat a patient, it's full focus on that patient and that procedure. But again, they got to pick their head up. When they're done, they got to look around. They got to reassess that whole big situation and dive down in. And the reason that's important in a business situation is you want to have that level of focus. But as a leader often, we want to be down and be micro-informed. We want to know what's happening in the weeds, but we can't get stuck there because we have to have the ability to zoom out, to toggle out to that macro view and see things objectively and say, is what we're doing here, does it get me to my desired outcome, right? And so we have to be able to detach and see the level of detail when we need it, but see the big picture as well.
That's a great example of that doctor too, by the way. Hammer sessions. So you guys used hammer sessions during SEAL training, and they obviously had a purpose. Would you mind sharing what they are and what they, you know, examples, and what is the purpose?
Yeah. So, and this is kind of a, it's not an official term that the Navy uses, but it's one of the things that it's the things that you don't, it's what I call the intangibles at BUDS that make it harder. And so a hammer session is really that impromptu beating, as we say, not the physical beating, but it's like, let's say you're doing something and it could either be a actual mistake that you or your classmates make as you're like, say, running to chow and you do something, maybe you, I don't know, just, I can't think of something, but let's say you make a mistake, or in many cases, they'll just perceive it. And they're going to sit there and you're going to do push-ups, you're going to do flutter kicks, you're going to do eight-count bodybuilders, which are like burpees with a little extra. And I remember we're doing all this. This is in second phase, so after we've been in Hell Week. And we're doing one of these hammer sessions, and it goes on and on. And the thing is, you don't know when it's going to end in most cases. And it's just extra stuff to wear you down. But I remember, you know, like this one instructor, he's like, do you know why we're hammering you today? And like one of the class officers was like, because we did this, because we did that. And he's like, no, because it's BUDS and it's supposed to be hard. And we all kind of got a chuckle out of that. And so it's just one of those things, right? It's the thing you can't anticipate. It's just one more thing to add stress and make your day harder. And so you just got to say to yourself, okay, it's going to make it through. This thing can't last more than like another 30 minutes because we have to go here and do this. So that's kind of in the back of our heads.
So it's off the script, something that the leadership wants to do to test their people.
Yeah, off the script. Maybe it's scripted, but as students, you don't know it. Maybe they plan on doing it, but maybe it's just impromptu. And they've kind of been, they've really kind of tightened that up a bit over the years, I think, now.
Yeah, I could probably venture into the territory of hazing, depending on the nature of it, I could imagine. So
all of Butts is pretty much hazing, so it's the name of the game. It's authorized hazing.
Authorized. It's legalized. Okay, so you were the Warrior Toughness Program co-creator. Kind of define for our audience the principles of warrior toughness and how did you design it? What was the genesis behind it?
Yeah. And so really what you got to kind of have this context in a lot of us or people joined the Navy in the 90s. And it was kind of like, and even after 9/11, it's like, hey, I want to serve, but I don't necessarily want to get boots on the ground. I don't want to be in the mud with the Marine Corps or, you know, riding around in the city with the Army. I'm just going to do this, right? Because I'm smart. I can push buttons and I can do all these things. And so we're all like the Navy would always market it. Hey, the Navy is the smarter service. But the problem is we'd become so detached from, you know, our forebears, right? Our ancestors back in, let's think, 1943 in the Pacific against the Japanese Imperial Army. We'd become so detached from those war fighting, you know, ethos and those, that type of mindset. And now what we were seeing was sometimes missiles would be fired at a ship going through a certain area off the coast somewhere, or, you know, we had ships collide and people were trapped and there was fires. And a lot of times these sailors, they weren't acting like warriors. I mean, some men and women would step up and act heroically, just exactly what you need them to do. But a lot of them were just kind of like locked down, right? They just weren't prepared to deal with that level of stress, because in regular Navy boot camp, we don't really train like war fighters per se. Like we don't do combatives and we don't do a lot of the stuff they do in the Army and Marine Corps. And so we realized that, hey, we need warriors on these ships. We need warriors in the rest of the Navy besides just SEALs. And so we created a program and the Admiral directed us. So then the story goes, myself, a clinical psychologist and a Navy chaplain, were kind of locked in a room and said, hey, we got to get our Navy sailors tougher and we're going to start here in boot camp, figure it out. And so the guidance we were given was create a program based on toughness. And the program's called Warrior Toughness, right? Mind, body, and soul toughness. And what we came away with, toughness is the intersection between mental, physical, and spiritual fitness. And so we created a program based on character development, based on our mental capacity, our mental skills, mindfulness training. And then the framework that I created for the program was really a framework based upon fundamentally how in the SEAL teams and special operations, we plan, prepare, and execute on a mission. And so that really became the commit, prepare, execute, and reflect. It was a four-part framework, a model that we used. And from there, we brought in lessons from the Stoics of the Romans and the Greeks for character development and really how to seek opportunity in bad situations and how to be your best in how to reframe situations. And then we did actual mental performance psychology skills. We did arousal control, what we call it energy management, self-talk that I discussed a little bit earlier, and visualization or mental rehearsal. And then we did mindfulness training, daily mindfulness exercises. And so that was really a cornerstone of the program.
Warrior toughness and that framework, how does that apply on Monday mornings for you now? How does it apply to your business as a speaker and author and coach?
Well, one of the things that, like, when I go into organization or even when I'm doing my coaching, my one-on-one coaching, it's really important that I kind of address the character piece. And that fundamentally really starts with you have to live your life if you want to get consistent results. Now, every once in a while, people can have success. They can have success as an individual organization, a team. But again, it's about optimizing performance in the face of curveballs, when things get really hard. And if you want to do that consistently, if you want to consistently seize opportunities when it's the most difficult, then you really got to know kind of fundamentally who you are. You got to really understand that character. And so you have to live in accordance with a certain set of principles. And so in order to get those principles, you first have to identify what are my personal beliefs? What are my values? You discover those values. And from that, you distill that down into what I call a personal mission statement. Personal mission statement. This is who I am. This is what I'm about. This is what I do. This is how I show up to the world. This is how I show up to the people that matter and in situations that matter. And from that, you know, I've created one for myself, and then I've got to have other people hold me accountable. Like people that I trust will hold me accountable. And I know it so well, I have to ask myself, am I accountable? Today, did I take a vote either in favor for the person that I want to be in the direction I want to go, or did I take a vote against that by behaving in a way that wasn't in accordance with those values and principles? And so that's really fundamentally where you have to start. And from there, when it comes to, say, my example on going up to deliver a program, a workshop, or a keynote, it's about reps and sets, preparing just like I would for a combat operation, doing the skills, putting the work in. And if it's particularly, you know, a big moment for me, and maybe I'm feeling a little kind of, maybe a little extra energy in the form of stress, I'm going to use some of the breathing exercises that we learned to calm myself down and sharpen my focus.
You're doing a great job, boss. I got a couple more questions. One, Stephen, is you're a dad. How many kids do you have?
I have two.
Okay. Boy and a girl?
I have a boy and a girl. I have a 17-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl.
Okay. So let's just take your son that's 17. He's probably going into a senior in high school next year.
That's right.
Okay. So what have you done? What have you taught him from your warrior toughness training that is going to help him be successful when he walks out the door and he signs up for the military or goes to college or does whatever he decides to do?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's one of those things where you say certain things, you repeat the process, right? And sometimes the kids, they just roll their eyes. And ultimately what you discover from people that have been there is you ultimately don't know. Like, you can get disheartened by sometimes, you know, especially when I talk to my daughter, you know, she's got a big soccer game and I want to tell her some stuff and she's kind of like, can we please not talk about this right now, right? Because often the most difficult messenger is the parent themselves. But ultimately, the people that have been there before say, hey, your kids are taking in a lot more than they're going to let on, that it seems like they're taking on. And so for him, he's been always been just a little bit more open to it than my daughter is at this point, even though I haven't given up on her by any stretch. And that's really kind of a lot of just the mental preparation aspect. And we talked about, you know, mental preparation. We talked about breathing. You know, I talk about, hey, the first time, like our mutual friend Anthony Trucks would talk about, you know, when he played D1 college ball, it was like, hey, the first time you're taking the field should not be the first time you're taking the field. So I'd actually tell him, I'm like, all right, think about this. What's it going to sound like when you take to the ice? All right, think about, you've had a successful shift. Focus on the good shifts you had when he plays ice hockey. I'm like, all right, well, okay, say you made a mistake. How do you re-engage? Because you're going to make a mistake. How do you re-engage? Just like a bad shot in golf. And so we talked a lot about those things. And I think it's just, you know, being able to kind of, the number one thing, even though it's not specific to warrior toughness, is really, and this is why most of us parents probably put our kids in athletics, is, okay, this is the training ground for life. This is where you get to feel hardship. You get to face failure. You get to take some risks. You get to collaborate, right? And so what I've really tried to do is get him to see the overall lessons of the things he's encountered, being cut from teams, losing games, like doing things right and being able to do it again, right? Those are the overall messages that I've tried to kind of instill in him and to a less successful degree, my daughter as well.
She's listening. She's listening. She's just not acknowledging it at the moment. Okay. So Stephen, one final question. I want you to ask yourself a question and give us the answer. And it's the question that everybody out there wants to ask you. What's the question when you do coaching that people want to know? When you do a keynote, what do people come up and ask you about after this, you know, the talk? You know, when you work with corporations, this is what they want to know. Share with the people what they want to know.
Yeah, there's a lot of them that I get quite often. But honestly, typically the one that I get is what was the hardest part about SEAL training. for you. That's the one that I often get the most. And often people are surprised when I tell them that it wasn't Hell Week, you know, because I think Hell Week, I had myself so prepared for it. Like I was like, I've got everything. Like if I, because I was so focused on that. But one of the things you don't realize is you have so much fat on the top of that milkshake, right? As you go in terms of your class. And so the instructors are like, right off the bat, clearly at least a good, you know, 15-20% of the class doesn't even belong to go, doesn't even belong here. They shouldn't even be going to Hell Week. And so those first probably week, they just hammer you almost as bad as Hell Week, in my opinion. And I think the one thing that I had, and it was difficult, and I was like, man, and I caught myself again, just like on that rooftop in Iraq, I caught myself thinking, okay, man, can I do this? And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, yeah, this is hard, but eventually they're going to have to teach us some stuff, right? So this, they can't do this the whole time. It's going to have to get easier or we'll never be in class. And I think many of the people just couldn't see that. They couldn't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And all they could see is the misery they were in right there. And so I remember a story I often tell is I came back. I think this was probably like in the first week of training. It was probably like Thursday or Friday. And I think I had like five roommates in the barracks that we were staying in at SEAL training. And I came back and all five of my roommates were putting their stuff in their bag. And I'm like, all right, well, what's going on? We moving rooms? And they're like, no, we're out. We like, and I'm like, they're like, this is not for us. And I'm like, well, still for me. So, and it's funny because every time somebody, and this sounds terrible to say, right? And if you ever watched the Highlander movie from like the 80s, you know, where that immortals, they chop a head off another immortal with a sword, right? And they get that power. And so every time somebody would quit, especially in Hell Week and in the surf zone and we're freezing, every time someone would quit, it was like, it made me feel stronger and more resilient. That's bad to say, I guess, but it's the truth.
More confident, more belief because other people were dying. How cold was the ocean? What was the temperature?
So we went, you know, a lot of people, they used to have the winter Hell Weeks and those are always the coldest. So I went through Hell Week, I think it was October. And so the average temperature typically is around 55 to 60 degrees. Which, and again, you get in there and you dip in there for a minute or two, it's not bad. But when you're sitting in that and you're in cold clothing all the time, and so they'll do what's called surf torture, surf conditioning, as they say, where you'll link arms and walk out online and you'll sit down and that waves will crash over your head, go up your nose and down your throat. And, you know, and it just, you just get cold, you're in and out of it. You come out and you shiver, you get back in. And that's it. But actually the coldest I got in SEAL training was by the time we went to the island and they made us go do over the beach training without wetsuits on. And so we're just basically swimming over the beach in the middle of February and off the coast, in these islands off the coast of California. And that's actually the coldest. I remember just jackhammering and being cold.
Wow. All right, Stephen. I want to thank you today for sharing your insights, your experience. I want to thank you for your tour of duty. Spent 27 years representing our country. How can people find you on social media if there's a company CEO or someone that wants your coaching or somebody wants to have you give a keynote? All those social media channels you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I love doing workshops. I love doing keynotes. And, you know, you want to learn more about me, you can check out my book, Life on the X, A Navy SEAL's Guide. So you can check that out. Or you can hit me up on LinkedIn, Stephen Drum, STEPHENDRUM, or my website, StephenDrum.com, STEPHENDRUM. So find me there. Hit me on Instagram. I don't have some kind of alphanumeric. It's just Stephen Drum.